good to go? Oh, yeah. No, exciting. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me back and not finding me and throwing stuff at me during lunch. How many of you were here in the morning? Oh, and you came back. How nice. It's nice to feel loved. Any Kiwis in the audience? Are you guys miss these? These? All right, we'll see what we do about those later on. So thanks for coming back. For those of you who weren't here, there are a few. My name's Stu Fox. I'm a technical specialist with Microsoft New Zealand. I specialise in the data centre business, so system centre, virtualisation, Windows Server, that kind of stuff. So I did part one this morning, and we talked about scale-up, we talked about storage, we talked about clustering and resiliency, we talked about automation and management, we talked about migration. This afternoon, we're going to look at networking, we're going to look at VM mobility, DR, Linux VMs, and actually Hyper-V server as well. I couldn't fit it on the page. Look, I'm going to skip the marketing slide this time. Do you guys a favour? I know, don't all groan. Funny story about that. Won't tell you now, but there is a funny story about that. So, networking. if you follow my Twitter feed, you'll know. So, same sort of thing. What have our customers told us about networking? And networking's been a really interesting area in Hyper-V. You know, when you look at what we've come from in sort of Hyper-V 2008 R2, we've come from kind of a really basic virtual switch that is, it does what it does well, but it doesn't have any smarts at all in it, really. It's kind of this dumb thing that just fires packets around, and that's kind of it. And it was missing a whole bunch of stuff that our customers were asking for. But when we went back and talked to our customers and also talked to, like a new class of customers that I don't think that we've traditionally spent a lot of time talking to, is that people like hosters, those kinds of things, and service providers, and our own internal service providers as well, people like Windows Azure and Bing and those sorts of things. We've talked to a bunch of kind of new customers, I suppose. They've told us a bunch of other stuff. So, how do I enable network multi-tenancy? How do I deal with IP address management? How do I deal with VMs competing for bandwidth? How do I leverage the network fabric I've got? How do I integrate with what we've currently got? How do I meter the network utilization? All sorts of stuff. So what we've done is, there are a bunch of things we've needed to do. So the first one is this concept of the hybrid cloud, right? So we've got customers with their own data centers, want to run stuff at a host, or want to run stuff in Windows Azure, those kinds of things. They've got a bunch of requirements. So how do we deal with multi-tenancy? And there is a session on, I think it's tomorrow, Phil's running it around multi-tenancy in Windows Server 2012. How do we ensure that we can run customer A, customer B on the same fabric and have them completely isolated from one another? And, there's a bunch of answers to that. Even further, how do we ensure that, as a customer, I can just move my workloads to the cloud without having to reconfigure the whole thing? When you go and look at it, a bunch of customers have got things like IP address dependencies and stuff, or they want to just bridge their network into a cloud data center. So how do I take my stuff that I'm doing locally, how do I extend it out into a provider's network? If I'm a hoster, how do I go about putting those customer workloads onto my fabric that I've built that might have multiple customers with the same IP ranges? How do I do it if my fabric's not set up to match the customer's fabric requirements? How do I deal with that? So everyone wants the ability to onboard a customer easily. Everyone wants flexibility. Everyone wants isolation. So one solution we've added inside Hyper-V is PVLAN support. And this was kind of one of our number one asks from hosts. We need you to support PVLAN. And the scenario is, there's a couple of scenarios. One is, we want to isolate all our customer environments into a single environment, but we've got this shared internet connection. We want to allow them all to go out via this internet connection. That's one thing we can do. So we can configure up PVLANs inside Hyper-V. That's done inside PowerShell. It's not something that's exposed through the UI. You can configure PVLANs only through PowerShell. You know, one of the problems that our hosters came to us with was that VLANs are kind of a pain in the neck to manage, because you know, for some of our hosters and some of our bigger hosters, 4,095 VLANs isn't enough. And some of them, you know, their networking gear can only handle a certain number. You know, there's a theoretical maximum of 4,095, 96, but, you know, their networking gear can only cope with so much. Or things like every time they make a change to add a new VLAN, they've got to make sure it's propagated through their entire network infrastructure to make sure that wherever they put a VM, it can access that VLAN. And, or, you know, you get the old story is like every time we make a change to our networking equipment, something breaks, you know, because we've done the configuration wrong or whatever. So these are kind of some of the things that our customers and hosters have told us, you know, around supporting VLAN. So we do support it, and it's there if you want to use it. But one of the other things we've done is introduce a new concept called Hyper-V network virtualization. And so in a similar way to what we do with machine virtualization, where we take our physical machines, convert them to VMs, and run them on physical hardware, every VM thinks they're running on, you know, their own dedicated piece of hardware. Same thing we do with Hyper-V network virtualization. So we can run multiple different customer networks on a single physical network. And every virtual network thinks that it's running its own physical fabric. It's, you know, it thinks that, oh, it's just this, I'm just here by myself with this virtual network, with this network. It's all for me. But it's actually running abstracted away. And there's some quite cool things we can do with that. And Phil will be talking about this in the session, I think tomorrow, around network, around multi-tenancy for Hyper-V. There are some pretty cool things we could do that, you know, run those conflicting IP address ranges with no VLAN support at all, you know, have a fabric that is completely, you know, you can have hosts in multiple different subnets and still have your same customer subnets spread across all those multiple subnets. You can do all sorts of cool things with this. If we get time, we'll have a look at it too. Some of the other stuff customers have said, reliability. When hardware fails, we need stuff to stay running. So that's that whole continuous availability story that I talked about this morning. And so there is another session again on NIC teaming and multi-channel, again worth seeing. So teaming. What about predictability? What about when we're competing for bandwidth? How do I do things like dedicate capacity to a VM? Or how do I ensure that a VM doesn't consume more capacity than it needs? And what about scalability? How do I scale my network performance so that I actually get the best utilization of the network and I get the least host overhead? How do I do that? And, you know, again, what about extensibility? You know, there's stuff that we do. What about adding other capabilities in? You know, I haven't talked about things like firewalling. I haven't talked about things like traffic inspection, that kind of stuff. How do we do those kinds of things? So we'll have a look at some of that too. So what we've introduced inside Hyper-V is this concept of an extensible virtual switch. So if you kind of think about where we were with Hyper-V in 2008 R2, we had the switch, and basically it was this black box. Traffic went into it, traffic came out of it, and that was kind of it. You couldn't do anything to the traffic once it was inside that black box. The Hyper-V made all the decisions around that. So what we've done with the extensible switch is we've basically added an extension protocol driver and an extension mini port driver underneath, and we've added the ability to do different levels of extensions inside that virtual switch. So first thing is we've added what we call a capture extension. And a capture extension is basically a read-only extension. And what that does is basically, all it does is allow you to look at traffic going through the virtual switch, and it sits at the top of the stack. And what happens is any traffic that comes down that virtual switch, it goes all the way down through the virtual switch, through all the extensions, and then back up again. So it's hitting all of those extensions. So the capture extension can see traffic as it hits the virtual switch before it gets modified by anything else, and it sees traffic as it leaves the virtual switch. So you see the last, you know, so it's basically first and last in the path. So it always sees the traffic as it hits the VMs. You can't modify traffic with a capture extension. It is a read-only extension. And we'll have a look at one of these in a minute. SFlow have done InMon have done an SFlow capture extension, and I'll show you that very shortly. We've also added the ability to add Windows Filter Platform extensions. And the reason we've done Windows Filter Platforms is because a lot of our vendors already write stuff like antivirus and firewalls for using WFP, and this allows them to take the knowledge they've got around building WFP extensions and leverage them into the Hyper-V extensible switch. So Five9 are building, and they have got in beta their virtual firewall product for the WFP extension. And so what we can do with the WFP extension, you can look at the traffic, you can modify the traffic, you can drop traffic, you can even insert traffic. So if you need to do stuff to the traffic, you know, change what it's doing, then you can do that inside the WFP extension. We've also added an Enders filtering API, which is functionally identical to the WFP API. It's just written for the Enders specification as opposed to the WFP specification. So this allows us to do basically exactly the same thing: capture, modify, inject, those kinds of things. And the last thing we've done is right at the bottom of the stack is a forwarding extension. And a forwarding extension is basically replaces the Hyper-V switching logic completely. So if you want to do something like the Cisco Nexus 1000V, you want to replace the router, the switching logic altogether with the Cisco switching logic, then this is where it sits in this forwarding extension. And at this point, the Hyper-V switching logic gets taken out of the way, and all that happens is that the Cisco one takes over. You can only have one forwarding extension running at a time in Hyper-V. You can have multiple of the other extensions going. And so Cisco have announced the 1000V virtual switch extension. I'm not sure when they RTM, but it probably isn't far off if they haven't done already. So let's just have a quick look at that. And it's kind of simple. So I've got Hyper-V host. If I look at the virtual switch manager, which used to be called the virtual network manager, it's now called virtual switch manager. I've got my virtual switch, same as what we always used to have, pretty much the same setting, but I've got this new tab for extensions. And so this just shows me the various different types of extensions, the various extensions I've got loaded, and I can enable and disable them from here. I can just, you know, untick them if I want to. So you can see I've got this S-Flow one installed there, and it's a capture type extension. And I've got a couple of others which are filter extensions. I've got the DHCP extension from VMM and a WFP extension in there as well. So that's kind of as simple as it is. You've got, you install the extension and enable it. That's kind of it. And with VMM, we're providing a bunch of capability around in Service Pack 1 around managing all that stuff centrally. So you can define kind of a logical switch and have all those extensions and configuration managed in a central location and pushed out to your Hyper-V hosts. So that's kind of all it is in terms of how it appears in the UI. It's all, again, scriptable through PowerShell. So we talked about PowerShell this morning. It's all, you can get to this stuff with PowerShell. You can turn these extensions on and off with PowerShell. So if you want to automate it using PowerShell, then go for it. So the S-Flow traffic capture virtual extension has got no real configuration. You can configure it up in the registry, but most of the configuration is done at install time. And how that appears and what that lets us do is, in this case, we're looking at an S-Flow trend tool from Inmon, and this is just showing traffic going through that virtual switch. It's capturing, I think, taking a snapshot of traffic every 30 seconds, so we're able to do all sorts of things. So this is the top connections view. We've got top sources. So I can see who's doing the most talking, so I can dig into the traffic and see what's going on using the S-Flow extension. So pretty, it's pretty simple. There was just this little extension installed, and now it's just firing S-Flow packets off to this collector here, and I can look at that, and that's refreshing on a real-time basis. The other thing is I can also come in here, and this is actually giving me back a bunch of other stuff as well, so I'm actually getting some host statistics out of this, so I can see how much memory is in use, so I can see what CPU is in use, so I'm actually getting a bunch of information as well. So that's a real simple example, but shows you how easy it is and how powerful it is to do this. So, that's the extensible switch. So, we'll talk about that. Advanced networking. So, hey, we can do port access control lists. another big ask. You know, how do I restrict traffic going between VMs? How do I put rules on that traffic? And so we do that with port ACLs. We'll have a look at that in a second as well. We talked about PVLAN support. We talked about NIC teaming. Network quality of service. So we can do things like set a per NIC reservation, or we can set a per VNIC limit. So we can, you know, stop a VM consuming too much traffic. We can also cap it at a certain limit as well. So if it tries to consume more, we can do that. And in a scenario, might be, hey, I've got a proxy box that I want to restrict access out to the internet. You know, I want to give it a certain amount of bandwidth out to the internet and no more. I'll do that via, you know, using network quality of service. And that's, and we'll have a look at this in a second as well. Network metering. So we looked at metering this morning. So I won't dig into that too much. But you know, network metering allows us to measure traffic going through the network switch, and do reports on that. So you could use that for chargeback. You could use that to figure out, you know, why so much traffic's going through a certain port. Those kinds of things. Dynamic VNQ and server SRIOV network support, both techniques allowing us to offload network traffic processing to hardware instead of doing it in software. So single root IO virtualization, SRIOV, PCIe standard, allows us basically to pull what we call virtual interface or virtual functions out of a physical network card and expose it directly to a virtual machine. So the virtual machine basically, in this case, with SRIOV, it completely bypasses the Hyper-V virtual switch. So if you want to use any of those extensions, you can't use single root IO virtualization. This is one limitation of SRIOV. But the really great thing about it is if you don't need any of those switches, SRIOV basically is a huge CPU saving, because all that network traffic that the VMs are doing doesn't have to get processed through the networking stack. It just goes straight through the SRIOV card. Get better throughput. And we actually do support live migration with single root IO virtualization. And we've had to be quite tricky about that as well. What we do, and it's kind of a neat little trick, actually. When we turn on single root IO virtualization, you end up with two paths from the virtual switch into the VM. You end up with basically a software path and a hardware path. And we kind of create this, we call it a team, but it's not done using the NIC teaming software, but you have a team of the software path and the hardware path. And when it comes time to do a live migration, we basically break the team and turn off the hardware path and just use the software path, move it over, and then we can reestablish the team on the other side if we need to. So we do a software-based migration, and then traffic keeps flowing. And during this whole process, traffic's not being interrupted at all, even though we're doing tricky stuff inside the VM to, you know, break these teams and create these teams. It's pretty clever. So, and yeah, there you go. So you can do it even if, you know, there's different NIC vendors, different NIC firmwares. Doesn't really matter. We can do it across this lot. Dynamic VMQ is another one of the offload techniques, and what that allows us to do is a similar sort of thing: offload virtual machine processing to physical network adapters. But the Dynamic VMQ actually allows us, what we had with the initial release of VMQ was a processor bottleneck in the host, in that it would only use CPU 0 to do the processing. Now we can dynamically spread the processing of this offload across multiple CPUs, and we get better performance. And the great thing about using VMQ is that we can use the virtual switch. So, you know, there are pros and cons using DVMQ or SRIOV, and it's just, I guess, it's kind of one of those what's right for you kind of calls. So there we go, and there's the other bit we can do is IPsec task offload. So if you've got IPsec task offload capable physical network cards in your machine, then we can pass that right up through to a Hyper-V guest as well. So a guest can do IPsec offload using the hardware in the host card. So that's pretty clever as well. You know, we think we'll see more and more IPsec over the next little while. It is kind of the foundation of security inside Windows Server networking these days. Anyone using IPsec out there? What about some of the other stuff? My favourite feature, it's called DHCP Guard, and I actually I renamed it Developer Guard. So DHCP Guard, basically, you know, if you've ever done this and you've ever given a developer a VM and they've gone, oh, this looks good, I'll install this DHCP role here and I'll turn on DHCP and I'll create a scope and I'll activate it and it's connected to your network and all of a sudden, you know, no one can get out, everyone's getting strange IP addresses. That's why I call it Developer Guard, because basically DHCP Guard, you turn it on, it stops that server acting as a, stops that VM acting as a DHCP server. Same with Router Guard, you can turn on Router Guard and that stops the server, it stops a VM advertising itself as a router. And also port monitoring. So this is one of the big things that I've actually been asked, you know, by a lot of customers, hey, I want to see what traffic is actually doing going through the virtual switch or to a particular VM or those kinds of things. How do I do that? And in Hyper-VR2, you know, we couldn't do that. We just had no way of doing it. We've added the ability to do a monitor port, so you can actually monitor traffic going through a specific through a port, be it physical or virtual. You can monitor those kinds of things. So, and that's just built into the box. And what about network bandwidth, quality service? We do all that through the UI, through the bandwidth management UI, and we'll have a look at this in a sec. In fact, right now. So, let's have a look at port ACLs first. So, I've got web server running on this VM, a TFS web server. One of the things I can do is with my PowerShell there, I can actually set a port ACL on this thing. And so there we go. We've got get the VM and add an ACL. So I'm going to block any traffic from 10.0.0.246, which is the host I'm on. I'm going to block it in both directions. So you can see the action is deny up the top there. So I'll hit that. And if I go and try and browse to the website, it'll just sit there doing nothing. Great demo, Stu, showing IE not working. And if I want to get rid of that, I can just remove the network adapter ACL, and there you go. Straight away, the page pops up. So they're, you know, real simple to do, but it's all port ACLs are all done through PowerShell. They're not exposed in the UI at all. So, but you know, easy to manage. And it's just turn them on and off, and you can see it. You know, just happens like that. So there's no delay. There's no waiting around for anything. The other thing is, how do we do quality of service? How do I limit traffic, those kinds of things? So what I'm going to do here is I've actually just got these two VMs. I'm going to set up a process to generate a bunch of traffic in between them. And so you'll see here in Perfmon, you'll see that traffic starting to ramp up. So I'm doing a whole bunch of traffic between those two guys. And so we're seeing that there. And with the with the bandwidth management, I can actually just set that and go, there you go, set a maximum bandwidth. And all of a sudden, there you go, that bandwidth is being throttled again, just like that. No traffic interruption, just the traffic just keeps going, but I'm actually throttling it. And the good news about the quality service stuff is that it all, of course, driven through the UI. So I can just come and set that. There, enable bandwidth management. I can just turn it off, and what you'll see is that network traffic jump back up again, so I can manage that. And if we go back and just have a quick look in that UI again, you'll see I've got the option to set a minimum bandwidth, and I've also got the option to set a maximum bandwidth. So the minimum bandwidth, I can dedicate bandwidth to a VM, and so it'll always be guaranteed that amount of bandwidth. And with the maximum, obviously, I can restrict it. So, you know, again, pretty easy to do. And like I say, you know, again, everything's automatable with PowerShell. You know, I guess I said this morning, if you haven't learnt PowerShell, you should. You know, this is just kind of future-proofing yourself question. So the question is, yeah, good to do on an individual basis. What if I want to do it on a whole bunch of things and a whole bunch of machines? Again, you could still use PowerShell to do it. That would be one way to do it. But the other one is Virtual Machine Manager. So Virtual Machine Manager lets you set... So the central management framework for all the stuff, Virtual Machine Manager. So there is a... And I don't know if there's a session on Virtual Machine Manager Service Pack 1 this week, but Virtual Machine Manager has got this sort of concepts of logical switches, and then I can't remember the other there's kind of a port profile effectively, and that lets you apply those port profiles across those logical switches, so you can sort of say, you know, here's the quality of service that I want to define and have that done. Have some milk bottles. Your path to type 2 diabetes. So like I say, we've expanded out the scope of Hyper-V networking significantly. I hope you all agree with that. There is a whole lot more capability we can do with this. So, you know, like I say, go and see some of those other sessions and dig deeper into some of these things. But, you know, we can do a whole lot inside the box inside Windows Server 2012. Right, next, VM mobility. So, we talked about this morning. Don't provide me new stuff, Microsoft, that doesn't work with live migration. If you're going to build a cool new feature, make sure I can still move my machine around. Make sure I don't have to turn off half the really cool stuff I can do with my virtual platform just to run this thing. Make sure it works with live migration. You know, you could see the stuff we did with single root IO virtualization is kind of smart. And it's the sort of thinking that the guys have had to do. How could we solve this problem but still enable live migration? You know, that's one of the things that we were told. I want to be able to move machines without limits. I want to be able to move them wherever I like, whenever I like. I want to move stuff. I want to take care of the fact that I'm doing SAN upgrades and migrations. And one of the other things is when I'm moving a VM, don't leave data about the VM behind. And actually, I didn't talk about this in the virtual switch thing, but the virtual switch extensions, you know, we've got capability built in there which allow you to, the policy will go with the VM. So when we're going to do a live migration, one of the things we'll do is we'll actually send a query down that virtual switch path to any of the extensions and say, I'm about to move this VM. Have you got any policy information that needs to go with this VM? And the extension will go, yep, here's the policy information, and it will send that policy information over to the remote host with that VM. So we can actually, you know, so that VM, if there is specific configuration, be it port access control lists, be it, be it specific port configuration, and maybe using the Cisco Nexus 1000 V and there's specific port configuration for that VM. If we're using the virtual switch with live migration, it will just take the policy over with it, as opposed to just leaving it behind and being locked to a particular host. And we want to leverage hardware to make sure these live migrations go as fast as they can. Some of the things that came out around the tech ed North America and Europe timeframe, you know, showed, you know, guys doing 10.8 gigabits per second, through these new RDMA cards of data transfer, not of bandwidth, of actual data transfer. They were getting 10.8 gigabits per second. So some pretty amazing throughput there. So, VM mobility. Live migration. It's been there all the time. We talked about it this morning. We've removed the limit around the number of concurrent live migrations. You can do as many as you like, as your hardware will support. We haven't put software blocks in place to do this. You can move as many as you like. Live migration with SMB. So if you're using SMB file shares to store your VMs, you can support live migration there as well. We've also added live storage migration. And we talked about this morning. Same thing. We haven't put software limits around this. We've basically said, you know, if you want to move your stuff live, cool, go for it. Just make sure you allow for the IO, for the IO that's going to happen as you do a live storage migration. So we don't, like I say, limited by hardware. We're not limiting you in software. I think Ben's doing a live storage migration or a live migration session later on today. Live storage migration is pretty easy. in terms of understanding it. It allows us to move our storage around on the fly. It will leverage the ODX stuff we talked about in this morning's session, so we'll be able to offload a lot of the storage operation to the SAN if it supports ODX, which is great. And I guess so from a move point of view, basically what we do is we say, hey, I want to move this VM storage from location A to location B. What we start doing then is we start doing a copy at the VHD layer. It's doing the copy at the background, you know, copying the source VHD from A to B. But we also start mirroring all writes as well. So any write that comes in for that VM, that gets mirrored over to that second location as well. So we're actually, you know, we start keeping the thing in sync from the word go. And once we've got to the point where that thing's synchronized, we basically start doing all operations on that destination disk. And once we're finished, we basically remove that source disk and we're away. So it's gone. And that's kind of as easy as storage live migration is. And of course, you know, it probably took the guys months to build it, but sorry, I won't belittle their work. But go and see Ben's session on VM mobility and live migration. And one of the other cool things we've built is this concept of shared nothing live migration. So so at the moment to do live migration, question. So the question was, is there anything like Site Recovery Manager which can move the whole thing? And my answer to you is, be patient. We'll get to that in about 10 minutes. we will get to that. So shared nothing live migration allows us to, at the moment our migration live migration is between hosts in a cluster. You know, the cluster is kind of the boundary of scale and the boundary of mobility. With shared nothing live migration, what we can do is move a virtual machine from one standalone Hyper-V host to another standalone Hyper-V host over the network with no shared storage at all, and do it on a live basis. So instead of incurring a downtime as we move the VM, we'll move it and we'll do it live. And like I say, all we share is a network connection, which is pretty damn cool, if you ask me. And the guys have obviously done a lot of work to make this happen. We'll do a demo here, but I won't because it locks up the console for a while I wait for it to happen. And I've got another demo I want to do, so I'll show you that after we've done the next demo. So we've basically got live migration, which is unlimited by hardware, and in fact, it's unlimited by even shared storage as such. So shared nothing live migration over the Ethernet just kind of works, and it's kind of magic. And like I say, Ben's doing Ver314 later on building live migrations and live storage migration. So on to DR. So disasters happen. So this is Christchurch in the South Island of New Zealand, just following the big earthquake they had there, and bad stuff happens. And bad stuff happens really badly. And I mean, locally there were a bunch of floods here, I think, and Japan had their tsunamis and things. So bad stuff happens. So how do we deal with that? But some of the things that people have been talking to us about DR, it costs a lot to do DR. It's complex. It's inflexible. How do we get that initial replication started? How do I actually do, I've got to replicate this 20 gig or 100 gig VM over the WAN. How's that going to work for me? But all my providers putting distance requirements on me, I can only replicate, but so I've got to be over a certain latency or whatever. So this is kind of the stuff we've been thinking about. And so what we've done is we've come up with this thing called Hyper-V Replica. And so again, this is an inbox feature. It's not a extra add-on or anything. Hyper-V Replica basically allows us to replicate virtual machines from one host to another. And that's replicate the full machine or replicate parts of the VM. It allows us to do things like plan and test our failover. It allows for planned and unplanned failovers. It allows us to do things like pre-configure our IP at the remote end. So when we do a failover, we can actually pick up a new IP address, and that's all been pre-configured for us. you know, the idea is that we give a return to service pretty quickly, and our replication, it happens every 5 minutes. It is built to run over slow connections. It's not built to run over, you know, great big fat pipes. It is built to integrate with all the other Hyper-V features like live migration and clustering and those kinds of things. And it is built to support heterogeneous storage, so it doesn't matter what you've got. You know, if you've got EMC at one site and NetApp at the other, doesn't matter. It's all software-based replication. And we integrate with VSS to make this happen. Again, Ben is talking about this as well, I believe. So he's going to talk in depth around Hyper-V Replica and have a look at that. So, but I thought I'd quickly show you a demo of this stuff happening. So, where am I here? So with Replica, Replica is real easy, you know, in terms of enabling. I can just basically right-click any VM and just go enable replication and run through a wizard of, you know, where am I going to replicate it to, whatever, and how I'm going to replicate it, whether it's, you know, Kerberos or HTTPS, and which VHDs I'm going to actually replicate. So, you know, so you might have a scenario where you're storing all your page files on a separate VHD and you don't want to replicate those. You know, maybe some people do that, and so this allows you to deal with that. And then we can say how many recovery points are we going to keep. You know, we can say, well, only keep the one, you know, only keep our replication point and no others. But we can also say keep us a couple replicas back as well, so we can actually roll back a bit if we want to as well. And then we can also say how we're going to seed the initial replica. So that could be, you know, the default is replicate over the network, but I might say, hey, export out the initial replica files and store those on a USB or whatever, and then I can take those and actually copy them on. So basically I don't have to worry about transferring, you know, hundreds and thousands of gigs over the network. Or I can even say I've got a VM already over there that's the initial replica, and you know, I can just go next, and then if I go finish, it'll start replicating and away it'll go. So real easy to enable. It's just a few clicks and a couple of options to select. And again, of course, you can do it all through PowerShell if you really want to. So you can script it. One of the things, I've got replication enabled on this guy, and so I can do things like I can see what the replication health is. I can see where it's replicating to, how much it's replicating, how often. And so it's in good health. And in fact, down on a VM itself, I can actually have an individual look at that as well, so I can get a summary. In fact, I don't know if anyone has seen the new Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V console, but my favourite thing is that for a VM, I can actually come down and see what the network settings are in the console itself. I really like that. So anyway, replication. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a planned failover. So for a planned failover, I'm going to have to shut the machine down. So I will shut that down. And we'll just wait for a second while that shuts down. Again, we'll have that uncomfortable silence. There we go. Off. So what I'll do is go replication, planned failover. And it's got a bunch of stuff it does. So I'm going to tell it to start it up. It, you know, it's got some prereq checks and then that kind of stuff. So if I just click failover, it'll do that. And the cool thing here is that it's reversing the replication direction. So now when it starts up, because I'm doing a planned failover, it's going to be replicating back the other way. So any changes that I've made, any changes that I make at the replica site, will be automatically replicated back to this machine, to this host as well. And away it goes, it started. So if I go and look over here, I should see a machine called SF Replica, which is up and running. So just like that, I've managed to bring this guy up, you know, fail it over, bring it up with no, you know, again, a couple of clicks. I didn't actually show you the networking tab. I did show the networking tab, but I didn't show the IP address. So the IP address we had at the other end was 210. Now we've got IP address 21. And so what we can do is on a per adapter basis, we can actually set the failover TCP IP addresses. So when this guy comes up, he's going to get 10.0.0.21, and here's the networking settings that I'm going to use for this side. And when I go back to the other side, I've also got the settings for this end of the replica as well. So again, I'll get 210. So I can fail over and fail back. That IP address will be dynamically injected in as the machine boots, and away I go. So there's no so I don't even have to reconfigure this thing to cope with the fact that I'm a different subnet. There is a question over the back there. Can the replica be offloaded using ODX? I don't think so, but mainly because replica, I mean, it's really aimed at multi-site as opposed to single-site, but I guess it could if you were replicating between hosts attached to the same storage. I honestly don't know the answer, though. So in terms of SAN replication, I'm not exactly sure on the integration story with SAN replication, so what I would suggest is go and see Ben's replica session and ask him about that one. Can you replicate to more than one location? No, you can't in this release. It's a single replica. And like I say, you know, all this stuff is scriptable with PowerShell, so if you want to script a failover, do that kind of stuff, then all perfectly doable. Sorry, there's... So I'll go you, and then you.
So on site after migration, is there ability to like integrate, say, scripts afterwards?
So the question is, is there ability to run scripts and post configuration? Not inside here. I'm not 100% what the story is. The story is kind of a little bit fluid at the moment around Service Pack 1 for VMM and what's going to happen there. My take on it, my personal take, would be probably that because you can script all this and do all that kind of stuff, personally I would probably build my failover plan in something like Orchestrator and use Orchestrator to run and execute those failover scripts as well. That's probably what I do right now without having any visibility of what's happening in the Service Pack 1 timeframe around supporting other stuff. So that's probably, you know, and I could change my story in a week or so and tell you something different, but you know, the honest answer, I don't know. There was a question here. What if I try and start that replica now? I'm actually not 100% sure what will happen if I try and start that replica, but what I can do...
Come on, give it a go.
Yeah, why not? I can also do a test failover. So I can do a test failover, which will bring that thing up.
That's nice. You've got two admins
fighting each other. There you go. It fails. Yep. Yeah, because replication's ongoing. But you can, like I say, if you do want to bring it up and test it, you can. So you can do a test failover, and that will... start the VM. Should. The question is, I assume you need DNS pointers to tell the client. Well, because we're updating the IP address, it should, in theory, update its DNS records itself using dynamic DNS, I guess. If you're using fixed and static DNS, yeah, then you'll need to do something to manage around that. Yeah. Oh, so there you go. I've got the test one, and I can start that up. And so that's... you know, you'll see that's connected, you know, it's not connected to a network and that kind of stuff, so if I want to just bring it up and have a play with it, I can do that and make sure it's working and that kind of stuff.
Sorry, just another question about DNS. What about service records that associated to the machine?
Again, that would be the responsibility of that application to re-register those service records, or, you know, if it was a poor example, but if it was a domain controller, then, you know, potentially it would have to re-register itself, but you wouldn't be replicating a domain controller anyway, probably. Cool. And like I say, if there are any deeper questions, please go and see Ben's session. It is, you know, he'll go into a lot more detail around that as well. So, Hyper-V Replica, it's in the box. You know, it is built And you know, I did say to you out there somewhere that I didn't know what the story was in terms of integration with hardware replication. I still don't exactly know how or whether we integrate or whether you can leverage one or the other. But certainly the software story is that it is built to do this entirely in software independently of the hardware. I don't know whether we can offload that stuff to Array or not. So Ben, maybe I'd answer that better. So. I guess the key takeaways, it's easy to set up. You saw me run through the wizard. It's not that hard. You can script it via PowerShell if you need to. It works with current hardware. You don't need any special hardware to do replica. It's super cool. And all you need is a couple of Windows Server 2012 boxes, and there's no guest dependencies as such to do this. So on to Linux and BSD. My favourite bit of all this. I've fixed my slide. I got hassled in New Zealand for spelling Ubuntu wrong, so I've fixed it up. Someone said, oh, typical Microsoft, don't respect Linux, can't even spell it properly. Yes, all right. So what we've done with Linux is we've actually opened our kernel drivers for Linux for the Hyper-V integration components. We've put those into the Linux kernel under the GPL. In March this year, we actually turned up as the top 20 contributor in the Linux kernel because of the massive amounts of code change we've done. So we've opened up those drivers. They are now part of the mainline Linux kernel. So that is for storage, networking, VM bus input, and the utilities like TimeSync and integrated shutdown and those kinds of things. There is one bit missing, and I can't remember what it is, but there is one bit missing from the open source, but it's getting there as well. But what this means is the fact that they're in the mainline Linux kernel is that basically you can pick up anything, any distro that's running though that version of the kernel, and I can't remember which one it is. I think it's 2.6.3 something. You'll be able to pick up any distro that's running that thing, and it will have support for the Hyper-V integration components built in, so you can just basically pick it up and start running with it straight away without having to install any extra software. So, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to support that, but it means that, for instance, because Ubuntu is not a supported distro, but you'll be able to run it up and take advantage of all the high performance drivers and stuff in there as well. SUSE Enterprise Linux actually include the drivers now. Ubuntu support include it now. So we can do this. We can leverage all the cool stuff like live migration, shared nothing live migration, storage live migration, those kinds of things. We can replicate Linux VMs with Hyper-V Replica, not a problem. We can manage them all centrally with Virtual Machine Manager, so they are pretty much first class citizens inside Hyper-V now, which is great. And so I think this morning I showed you a couple of screenshots of Linux VMs running heaps of processes and that kind of stuff. So they can take advantage of the VM scale improvements as well. So if you want to run a 64 vCPU Linux VM, go for it. It's all good. So as of last night when I was doing this, the supported distros we've got, and in fact, last night we released the Linux Integration Services 3.4, so the latest release, and I think that added Red Hat 6.3 support. So we now support Red Hat's 5.7, 5.8, 6, and 6 all the way through to 6.3 with Integration Services 3.4, and CentOS, same versions because CentOS is effectively Red Hat Enterprise Linux except the community distro. We support SUSE 11 SP2, and we also announced a couple of months back that we're supporting FreeBSD on, and I know it's not Linux, but it's FreeBSD on Hyper-V as well. And there's the link to get the, you've got to build the Hyper-V drivers yourself for FreeBSD, but it is also available there as well. And I guess the last bit that we're going to talk about today is Hyper-V Server 2012. So Hyper-V Server is basically our entirely free version of Hyper-V. So it's an ISO you download from the Microsoft website, microsoft.com/HVS. And what it is a fully functional version of Hyper-V. It is command line only, so you don't get any UI except for cmd.exe and PowerShell. There's no OS licensing included with it. There's no guest OS licensing included with it, but you can run it up. Basically, stick a DVD in your machine, boot up, install it. Hyper-V is pre-installed. It supports all the Hyper-V features. So it supports replica. It supports failover clustering. It supports live migration. It supports storage live migration. All those things. It's basically a fully functional hypervisor, but free download. Sorry, I said again. Pardon me. .NET framework. That I don't know. I'm guessing so because it runs PowerShell. But so the thing you can't do with Hyper-V Server that you could do with say an instance of normal Windows of full Windows Server is that you can't do things like add Active Directory roles or add file services roles or those kinds of things. You can't do that stuff, or IIS, for instance. And because there's no UI, a lot of stuff, stuff that you might traditionally try and run on a server might not work. But things like Operations Manager and Virtual Machine Manager and Config Manager, they all work on Hyper-V Server. So, it is a great tool for Linux VM consolidation. It's a great tool for VDI. Why would you buy a Windows Server license to run VDI? Because when you can run it for free effectively and just manage it remotely. It's a great platform for hosters as well. It is stripped down, so it's there's no extra stuff on you. Like I say, no one can muck around with it and go, oh, I'm going to install AD or I'm going to install DNS or whatever it's going to be. It's a Hyper-V server. It's dedicated to that, and that's all it can do. And it has all the same benefits of lower patch footprint that Windows Server Core does as well. So like I say, you can get it at microsoft.com/HVS. And there's our little comparison. So, we'll support all that cool stuff. We'll support 64 virtual processors. We'll support up to 4 terabytes physical memory in that box. We'll support 64 VM, up to 1 terabyte of RAM in a VM. We'll support live migration, live storage migration. We'll support replica, shared nothing live migration. We support remote FX in this guy. We support storage spaces. We'll support the SMB file share support. So basically, this is a Hyper-V, free version of Hyper-V, which is completely unlimited, and all that great software stuff you can get in the box. So this session actually is a little bit shorter than the first session, so we're pretty much finished. So we've had a look at networking, we've had a look at mobility, we've had a look at DR, we've had a look at Linux and Hyper-V Server. And that's kind of it for now. If there's any questions, feel free to ask. I've still got a bag of pineapple lumps and a bag of milkshake. Oh, you want some pineapple lumps? How many recovery points can you keep? The answer to that is I'm not 100% sure. I suspect that just relies on disk space more than anything else. And utilization. So. Any other questions? On Hyper-V server, how do you patch management? The same way you do patch management on any other server. It's got Windows Update support on there, so you've got a command line tool, you can do Windows Update, but you could use Config Manager, you could use WSUS, you could point it at WSUS, absolutely. It's fully functional in that regard.
Is the Hyper-V Replica supported on Hyper-V Server?
Is Hyper-V Replica supported on Hyper-V Server? Absolutely, absolutely. Is the replicas LAN-based? No, it is designed to work over WANs as well. Do you need to dedicate a network to it? The answer is it depends. It will be whatever the change is. So if you're replicating stacks and stacks of VMs, then you're going to use more bandwidth than if you're just replicating a couple. So it's kind of a how long is a piece of string question. It's. It can be Wayne, effectively, yeah. Can you throttle a replica with Windows Server 2012 Quaz? Yes, you can. You can throttle the replica bandwidth.
Does the Windows 8 Hyper-V include any of these features at all?
Does the Windows 8 Hyper-V include any of these features? Yes, it does. But I would struggle to tell you which ones it doesn't include. But yeah, it doesn't include replica. I think you can do live storage migration with that. I'm not sure about virtual switch extensions. Don't know.
So this would work if with multiple clients, if you wanted to have a system that would basically be a replica.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so the question is, this would work if you wanted to be, if you're a hoster and you wanted to provide a service for clients to replicate to, and I could have a single replica server coming, acting as their incoming? Absolutely. Have I ever done hyper-replicas over satellite links? No. I would go and talk to Ben about that, actually, and see what he thinks. I suspect the answer It'll be an interesting question. I really don't know what the answer will be. I don't know whether that would be too much or whether you wouldn't be able to replicate it. It would, again, it would kind of depend on how much you were trying to replicate, I think, more than anything else. It's 15, is it? Okay, maximum replication is 15. Thank you. So is there an embeddable version? I can't remember what the footprint is, actually. It's reasonably small, but, you know, it's still an installation of Windows, so it's still, I don't know, a couple of gigs or so these days. So you could run it on, you know, SD, I suppose. There's kind of a complicated story around that, but it is kind of... what we've seen is we've seen people try and do it on SD cards, and the performance... in SD is so variable that if you don't choose the right performing one, then your performance on the host will really, really suffer. So that's kind of why we haven't made that publicly available. It is available to OEMs to do, but we haven't sort of made it available for just anyone to do, because they'll go, I stuck it on my $5 USB key and it didn't work. Not to that, yeah. Oh, God, I didn't show you. Forgot. But look, it's kind of unexciting. So look, it's basically as simple as in the console, I've got move, and I can choose what sort of move I want to do, so I can move the whole VM, or I can just do a storage move. You know, either move is a live move, and pretty much, obviously this isn't going to finish in the time that we have here, but pretty much what we'll do is go next. Use the same host, and I'm going to just move the whole thing. I'm just going to move it to the default location on the remote host. I go next and finish, and that's basically just going to do the migration for me. And so that's going to take however long it takes, and that move is going to happen live. So I don't have to configure anything to do this to do it live. It just kind of happens, and so Hyper-V is just dealing with that in the background.
Is that just moving the actual guest and not the storage, or is that doing storage?
That's doing storage. That's what it's doing right now. So it's doing the storage, the guest, guest configuration, and guest running configuration as well. So it's doing the lot.
Live migration question. If I need to live migrate to 20 virtual machines automatically, can I set it up to migrate, for example, two virtual machines at the same time, no more than two?
Yeah, so... So the question is, if I want to migrate, say, 20 VMs at the same time, but I only want to do two at a time, absolutely. I don't know if the console is going to let me do this, but oh yeah. In Hyper-V settings, there is a setting right there which is how many simultaneous live migrations am I allowed to do, and that's set to two by default. So by default, what you're asking will just happen.
Is that per VM setting?
That's per host. Yep. So that setting is per host. So and the console supports queuing of the moves. So if you select all 20 and go move, it will queue the moves. So it will do the two, then the next, and the next, right?
The PVLAN, how you come talk to the two hosts? You need to configure for PVLAN on both hosts.
Yeah, for PVLAN, how do I do PVLAN across multiple hosts? Yeah, you need to configure it on every side.
Otherwise, you won't talk to each other.
Correct. Otherwise, it won't. Yeah. With the scenario here, I don't have a cluster.
Okay, so if I lost one of the Hyper-V hosts, I lost everything.
Yep.
There's no automation behind, or I can put some automation.
That would be where we'd use replica, those kinds of. Yeah. So you know, if you had two standalone hosts and you wanted to do something that give you higher availability, you would use replica to replicate the VMs between the two hosts, if you weren't going to cluster. There is no difference now. A cluster doesn't. So Windows Server 2012 ships in two editions, standard and data center. They both support clustering. They both support exactly the same amount of hardware. They support exactly the same features. The only difference in between Windows Server 2012 standard and data center is that standard supports gives you the use right, or gives you the guest licensing rights for two guests. Data center gives you the guest licensing rights for unlimited VMs. That's the difference. Everything else, clustering comes into standard. 64 nodes in a Windows Server cluster standard, you can build that. That's not a problem. You can use Hyper-V Server, the free version, to build that 64-node cluster if you want to. So you don't even have to license the hypervisor component at all. So if you want to do it, you can do it with a completely free version of Hyper-V and build a cluster. It supports all that stuff. We changed the license. I know, aren't we nice? How many replication locations can you have?
Like, what I'm trying to say is that, okay, this week I would like to replicate a virtual machine to location in Sydney, and next week I would like to replicate to Brisbane or something, kind of like that. The reason for that is the, just if something happens, I will always have like a two.
So in this release, it's only one location that you can replicate to.
So it's only one.
It's only one.
So it's going to be two Sydney, and that's it.
Yep.
Can I schedule something like? Okay. Simplify the example. I've got two buildings. They reasonably close to each other, right? So two Hyper-V hosts in both of those, right? One of them is like a primary extra one. All those virtual machines are running there, you know, production kind of thing. So I create the replica of this virtual machine to another building, right? So can I set up a schedule saying that 1 week I would like to be that building to be active, and next week this building going to be active? Reason for that, because as you know, if the replica works fine, it's not a problem with it.
You could do that. It would incur an outage as you switch, but you could do that. If you want to do multi-site protection, then you start using things like DPM to do backups and do DPM to protect DPM, you know, those kinds of things. So, you know, DPM takes a backup locally, then we replicate that off to another data center, those kinds of things. So, yeah, but you could do that. But like I say, there would be an outage as you switched over the replicas from site A to site B and then back again.
So I can do it at night, perhaps?
Yeah, you could do it at night.
But the reason for that, let's say, if I can run this week all of this virtual machine in this building, they're fine, they're working, good. Next week, I run other ones, you know, they're working, they're good.
Or you could use the test functionality to the test functionality in Hyper-V replica. So you could bring up you could periodically start the VMs on the other site in test mode and do a test failover and see what happens. And so you could do that as well. You know, that would be the other way to test it without having to do the full failover. You could just go test, are these replicas looking okay? Yes, I'll just keep working.
So would you recommend that scenario?
I would probably go with test rather than actually failing over. I mean, in some ways, though, doing a failover is kind of good practice, you know, because when you actually do one, you learn all the stuff that breaks. And so if you were to do that test failover, then potentially, yeah.
But see, we need that for high-availability virtual machines. So if something happened to that virtual machine, it has to be on all the time. And, you know, recovering from DPM does take time.
That's right. Yeah, it does. Yeah. So replica would be one or the other. Yeah. Any more? Yep. Over there.
So with regard to replication and failover, would it only auto-failover if you're in a failover cluster?
The replication and failover is independent of clustering.
Yep.
So
it doesn't do automatic failover?
It doesn't do automatically failover, no. It is a manual failover process.
Is that coming in?
Don't know, but the what you would do. I think because people, I think, and rightly so, people probably are a bit freaked out by auto failover of your replicas, because you know it potentially could be, you know, I move from Sydney to Perth or something. I don't know. To pick two random Australian cities that I know, you probably wouldn't really want that to happen on an automatic basis based on some glitch or something. So you'd have a DR plan that was built, I don't know, in Orchestrator or VMware, whatever it happens to be, and you would execute that plan should you hit a disaster, and that would kind of be the scenario. You wouldn't, yeah. You, It's kind of different in the cluster when you're talking about, hey, I lost a node. That's fine. The automatic failover happens there as part of clustering, right? And that's kind of what happens. That's what it does.
Hey, with part of the server 2012, if